Hello, and welcome to Two Broads and Two Deep, the Doctor Who podcast, where we go through the Doctor Who Virgin New Adventure novels through from Time of Genesis to the Dying Days. I'm Anthony, and I'm joined by Alistair.
Oh, Anthony, good to see you.
Good to see you. How are you doing?
I'm surviving, I think, more or less.
Grand. Now, well, I guess we're trying to think if there would be any news about new adventures, and there technically is, since there's a new series of adventures coming our way in the following month. And we got a wee trailer, I think it was last week, that we got.
We did, yes, we got two in quick succession, and...
Yeah, it's novel to have a new Doctor Who after such a long period of a drought. It's almost like we're back into the wilderness here sometimes. But how did you find that trailer?
The first one was fine. It was functional. It got me a wee bit excited. It was quite good. The second one really dragged me in. I was a lot more excited after the second one. What about yourself?
I think it was about the same, just because, you know, we got some flavour of Chutey in the Christmas special, but, you know, it's hard to judge because we're in, again, a different era to, you know, Chris Chibnall and how he had a bizarre way sometimes of doing trailers. It didn't quite whet the appetite in the same way. Like, I always think about that trailer at the end of, I think it was The Woman Who Fell to Earth, when it was maybe Spyfall. No, I think it was The Woman Who Fell to Earth. And it showed just a montage of different actors, as if, you know, the intended audience, typically of younger people, would know, oh, it's that obscure actor who was maybe, you know, in a run of Casualty 5 years ago, or whatever. It didn't spark the interest in a way that, you know, Russell T. Davis knows how to make sure there's zappy images with zappy lines, making sure we're getting involved.
Davis has always known who his audience is, and he's quite happy to cater to us, and that's fine. We are very happy with that. I'm over the moon as well that we haven't got series one yet, but we're already getting news about series two. It's like, oh
yes, we got a new companion announcement. I forgot about that.
And it's so nice after, here's your series, now sit tight for a couple of years and we might give you some more.
I did, however, enjoy, because, you know, this insinuates there's going to be two companions in season two that we're going to get. The press release of it did say that we're excited to have Varada, who, you know, is coming on board. But in it, it says that never before has the Doctor had two companions at once. Now, the ire of many a 60s fan got quite high. Including even quite literally Peter Purvis, because I saw a tweet from him saying, "What total tosh. There are two companions in almost all of the 46 episodes in which I appeared, and prior to that there were three. In Patrick's time there were mostly two as well. This idiot is talking complete rubbish."
Yes.
Now, I'm sad he didn't say what complete Donald tosh, you know, since that was his showrunner for most of it. But, you know, it was... maybe someone who needs a bit of research to be making such bold statements for the BBC publicity department.
You don't even have to go back as far as the classic series. I mean, the Pawns, Rory and Amy.
Yeah.
It's...
And even actually, even later, Bill and, is it Nardo? Yeah, Nardo.
Yeah, of course, Bill and Nardo.
That was a two-companion time as well, so...
Yeah, it's just... No, it's... But you do
even the Flux.
Oh, aye.
Yeah, Yad and Dan. Although by halfway through the Flux, about everyone in the Grand was a companion.
Yes, that was...
So.
But you do get the impression that BBC publicity is not in step with Russell T Davis just now.
Yeah.
Especially after the announcement that we'd be launching an iPlayer the same day as Eurovision. And...
Oh, God, yeah.
He didn't say anything, he was quite discreet, but he went and liked every single post that said, "This is a bad idea." He just quietly clicked, like.
To be honest, I think if you gave any sort of typography to his comment section, he would give it a like. Like, he's been liking some mad stuff on his comments, even things that just deride his trailers. But, yeah. Now, you may be wondering, everyone listening, why we're not talking about the book yet. And it's not out of, you know, dislike for this particular one. It's just, you know, similar to the length of this book, there's not much to say. Because today we're covered in Time Worm Apocalypse by Nigel Robinson.
Yes.
Now, it's the third in the series of the Time Worm series. And, you know, it is, I think it's almost on the dot 200 pages long. 201,
201, yep.
including the epilogue. So it's a very short novel.
Doesn't feel it.
That's the thing, despite the fact, you know, it's 201 pages long, that's a lot of filler. Even to the minutiae detail of sentences, it feels like sentences just feel longer and more protracted. It's, you know, I feel we're already going into the discussion of this, but I think we'll first of all maybe give you a flavour of what this book's about before we get into the feelings about this book. So for you at home, here's what the blurb tells us of what this book is about. The end of the universe. The end of everything. The TARDIS has tracked the Time Worm to the edge of the universe and the end of time. To the lush planet Kerith, a paradise inhabited by a physically perfect race. Ace is not impressed. Kerith has all the appeal of a wet weekend in Margate, and its inhabitants look like third-rate Aussie soap stars. The Doctor is troubled too. If the Time Worm is here, why can't he find her? Why have the elite Pangistri lied consistently to the Cariffans they govern? And is it possible that the catastrophe that he feels impending is the result of his own past actions? Now, that doesn't quite describe some of the strands this goes to, in the way that we want. I don't know if maybe Alistair, what actually does happen in this book?
Oh, that's a very good question. It's basically, if you've seen The Doctor's Daughter, you're not too far away from what's happening. Civilization's been created. They think they're ancient. They're actually about two generations old. And they're some kind of perfect species. And even the way that was done was like, what? It's the end of the universe, but it's not really the end of the universe. The mate, Grand Matriarch's been looking after them for 5,000 years. She may or may not be the Time Worm.
Yeah, I mean that's the crux of it is that discussion about, you know, this planet. Basically, Kirif, planet at the end of the universe, race of humans, humanoids, who are just kind of like docilely going about their days, nice, perfect, idyllic lifestyle within this planet. And there's the kind of ruling class on an island within this planet, the Pangistri, who they just send their best and brightest to. Almost kind of as a sideline, I was watching The Crotons recently. I don't know why I was watching The Crotons recently. I just
I wasn't judging. I was not judging.
it felt a lot like we were stuck when we were reading this book. It felt like we were stuck in episode, even just the first half of episode one of The Crotons, because at least in The Crotons they evolve past the deceit of their benevolent rulers quite quickly. This novel does not do that in a quick or fashionable way.
I was trying to
It's
work out how it would have gone differently if the Doctor and Ace hadn't landed. And I don't think it would have.
yeah, I mean there's, well, there is still, you know, the crux of the push that Ace and his Doctor do give to this, but it's the fact that even with them there, the people writ large still actually backtrack on their own rebellion. So, you know, this
Yeah.
idea of the docile class of folk within Kerith, the main crux of this is that they find out they've been mind controlled. They have this food substance which they eat quite regularly, which is given to them by Pangistri,
Yep.
and they basically are subdued by them, kind of like Macra Terra, I guess, with how that is, to try and like the gas there to maintain that class. Now they kind of do start within about two-thirds of the way to actually develop cognizance of the issue, because the food substance that they are eating is actually their own people from various genetic experiments and such. But
Yeah, that.
they decide to just like be unfazed by that after about a day or two. It's so bizarre, because it's if anything, it's one of the almost like failed revolutions, like within Doctor Who. Like, it doesn't succeed.
No, they fall back into their old habits very, very quickly, and it just has to keep going. Guys, revolting, we're having a revolution. Come on, move, move, move.
Yeah.
And it's. But. You do get the impression, though, that Raphael would have led a revolution had he been given enough time. He was obviously questioning things, wasn't sure how it was going. Actually, no, there we go. There's the change that the doctor made. He stopped Raphael from drowning.
Well, I don't think I agree, because the issue was basically, whilst this revolution is taking place after Ace stopped the food supply to the main folk in Kirriff, Ace and the Doctor and the merry band of locals, which is Raphael, who is, I don't know, just generic bland lad. He's just like this wholesome, simplistic hero, sort of person who wants to be exploring, and he's up for, new experiences to an extent, but
Yeah,
not
he's about
fully.
two drafts away from being a fully realised character. He's not quite there.
Yeah. So there's Raphael in this planet. There's Meryl, who's like his learned father figure, who sometimes wishes to go to the stars, but he's never dared try to do anything about it.
I actually really, really like Meryl. I wanted to see more of him. He was quite.
See? Yeah.
It was.
It was bizarre having, these bands of people, and it kind of go, like we say, kind of they've got no agency of their own, because my main thing is, the merry band of folk go with the Ace and Doctor to try and go to the source of issues and pin in the Pindustry, but the revolution kind of stalls because there's not really the Doctor and Ace there to
Push it
physically
on,
push
yeah.
them to go through the door and do stuff there. It's as if, the writer just didn't give any agency to anyone on that ground to do what we would expect within a typical, self-sparked revolution story in Doctor Who, because in essence this is a generic, if not one of the most generic Doctor Who
Oh,
stories you could do.
yeah, it's. It's bland, which is the worst crime for Doctor Who. It's just there. It's even the character development, Revna, yet another character whose name starts with R, as you pointed out. She outright states her character development. If she can't be a woman in love, she's going to be a woman full of hatred. And that's her one bit of character development, and she outright states it. This is what I'm going to do now. And it's like, okay. The subtext has become actual text.
Yeah, that's the thing. There's no, it's quite Garth Marenghi style sort of subtext. It's for cowards sort of level sometimes. Yeah, I mean, there's elements of good stuff there, like you say with Meryl,
Oh, love Meryl.
on the planet. But the issue is that they just, without the Doctor and Ace physically taking their hand to do things, this is the issue, because the general idea is there's a utopian society, and held supreme it's the Pindustry who are these overseers who actually don't have good intent. Their main thing is supporting the Grand Matriarch, the Great Matriarch,
Grand, I think, yeah.
to create her own God engine,
Aye.
basically, to save the end of the universe, because this is taking place at the end of End of Time, and I don't want to get into to my minutiae, just like issues that I have with that idea, but it's basically some way to try and maintain the universe before
The end of it.
the end of it, but the end of it in an ill-defined way, because it's talking to the end about the Big Crunch. Now, the Big Crunch being, the whole universe instead of Big Bang, which going out exponentially, it's the Big Crunch. Everything goes down into a singularity. But we also then interchangeably talk about like the heat death of the universe, which is a different
Yes,
thing.
it's they don't coexist, those two concepts. They just don't.
No, because that's like about, the equilibrium of thermal dynamics and almost like, I think it's the Big Chill protocol or something as well, or Big Freeze. It's not the same idea of everything compressing to the singularity. So it's maybe not, it's bizarre having science fiction concepts being so
Yeah,
interchangeably
that's.
used in what's meant to be a broader, more highbrow science
I
fiction
got the
novel.
impression it was basically put in there to try and give it some sense of urgency and crisis, and it just didn't work. I mean, if you look at things like, say, Utopia and the new series of Doctor Who, they had 45 minutes and they created quite a sense of urgency just with this, with the rocket having to escape and the professor and Professor Yana and the doctor going to help other reprogramming things. If you're going to do the end of the universe, you need to have urgency and impending death. There was never a feeling of any kind of crisis heading towards these people at all. And that's highlighted by the fact that once it's all over, the doctor goes, "That's fine, they've got a few billion years left." Sorry, what? The universe is ending in 9 billion years. Well, I'll just cancel them out for Monday, will I?
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, parts of the book goes into, I think the opening of this, the prologue is trying to give that idea of the end of the universe through Logopolis's lens. And was it as CVEs, I think it was, within Logopolis, which is, there to try and control the universe before everything just collapses. It's not something that we
Yeah, but
see
you.
as an impending issue in this suddenly, because there's
No.
now these, continuation for many, many more eons to come.
Yeah, and the idea that the God Engine's going out to explore life as we know it, essentially, it's like, well, there's obviously things out there. So it can't be the end of, anything. And if it was the end of the universe incoming, why would you start a whole species from scratch?
Well,
Why?
that's the big crux as well. So, the plot being the reason why why they're creating, or how they're able to create the God Engine, is by basically manufacturing their own race of folk to find the perfect beings, to manufacture perfect elements to make this omnipresent God Engine.
I mean, I don't know if we've touched on this before, but my background is science. In science, I studied in science. But when I read and watch Doctor Who, I quite often have to disengage my inner scientist. And normally he'll just sit quietly and go, "Okay, fine, right, maybe." But he was screaming in my ear through the whole of this book. He was really, really pissed off. I was like, "None of this goes together. And my voice just went all high and squeaky there, but it's just no, that's not how breeding works, that's not how genetics works, that's not how anything remotely close to this works. It's lots of ideas that are half thought out and don't quite hang together. And Nigel Robinson has kind of stitched them half together, hoping they make a whole plot, and they don't.
Well, this is the thing. I was reading his interview in Doctor Who magazine 178, and he's talking about how, genetics is one of his interests, which I found an interesting idea, because I don't know what side of it, because it's not certainly the morality of it. That's not very much explored. It's almost explored in a camp comical way, because not comical, more so just, I mean that in terms of like a comic book sort of way, quite broad strokes of it, because you know they and in this they think everything's you know perfect in this land in Kirith, but Ace takes them and they find this basement where there's a big globule being fetus sort of massively oversized thing, the homunculus, which it's quite a good name to be honest. That's I
Yeah,
quite
that's
like
got
that,
its roots, but
but
yeah.
it's this kind of comical, you know, broad stroked idea of like horrific genetic experimentation, but it's never a theme that's been, you know, kept hammered throughout. There's companions as well, who are assistants to the Pangistri, who are these deformed animals that kind of been there as well, but there's no discussion or you know intersection of what we see of these things with a morality discussion or tale
Because having
within it.
looked at, having studied genetics, the morality is a huge, huge part of it. That was part of my lectures, that was part of my coursework. It is integral to any good story you tell in science fiction regarding genetics. You throw the morality in. It's the big question mark. And it just wasn't really touched on in any way, shape, or form. It was, apart from the other bad guys, they shoot us. Well, yeah, but they shouldn't be doing this because the science is crap, not just because it's. Yeah, it's.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I was in that same interview, he talks about what he initially was going to do with Apocalypse, and he was talking about how he's going to set it on Earth a couple of million years in the future, where the human race had been evolving beyond recognition, and someone in the past had tampered with the evolution. And so it was going to be an idea on that scale, which would have
I
been
quite
quite
like that idea,
interesting.
yeah.
In fact, kind of touches almost on what you were, what it kind of almost touches on what you were saying about Utopia, actually, with the future kind. You know, that was within that story, they're like, oh, we don't know where they came from and how they've evolved, but we don't want to evolve into them. And there's that kind of morality discussion there, but there isn't that really in what becomes Time of Apocalypse, because the evolution point is quite literally to a point for a continuation of the universe. There is, I think, a brief discussion within the end of the book, because they have to balance between not what's happened with the, you know, creation of a race specifically for this. It individualizes the morality issue, because, you know, like we said, the evolution point is about making a whole race of people just to create a god engine. And the end of this novel is about sacrificing Ace into the god engine. And the Doctor's morale dilemma is, do I sacrifice Ace, one person, for the livelihood of billions? Which, you know, fine enough morality tale, but is an issue that we've had, you know, many times before, and it's not the one that's set up, because it's, you know, by the end of this, spoiler alert, we have Raphael getting sacrificed into the God Engine. But there's no discussion of why should this God Engine even exist, because it's created on the extractions of a created race just for its purpose. And should this race have, you know, their own existence and right to not have this God Engine created out of that? There's no discussion of that side of it. It's just about, oh, will I save Ace?
They
Will I
never think of
save, you know, something? It's very immediate and just about individualistic issue, rather than broader, deeper, as it were, you know, point about why you have this genetic race created by Dendrisiou in the first place.
He never even considers the option that maybe destroying the God Engine is a thing he could do. Maybe he could stop that. Maybe he doesn't need to sacrifice Ace or Raphael. And that's before we even touched on the idea that they were going to take Ace's genetic components to take her anger. Anger is a genetic component really bothered me. That's... It was just...
Yeah.
It went from the Doctor not knowing what was going on, piecing things together, and then 5 seconds after he arrives in the space station, understanding it all and sacrificing Raphael. And Ace, at one point that I say, like, Ace getting really, really angry at the Doctor, which I liked, for sacrificing Raphael, and it's like, how could he possibly have known what was going to happen? There was no way. None at all.
Yeah.
It's...
It's a very surface level explanation of this idea of this deep, darker Doctor. It's hinted at in this, but only by literally superficially saying how he's a darker Doctor, not really anything about it. Because, you know, even things of he was here before, it kind of technically wasn't. Yeah. It was the Time Worm really just kind of taking a previous incarnation into
it wasn't even this
realm
world.
Very
met,
briefly, it was not
he met
really...
Lilith, the little girl, on a different world 5,000 years previous. They made a point of saying the Pangestry came here a few thousand years back and started from scratch after the Doctor's visit. So there was no way any of the Second Doctor's adventures actually factors into this adventure. But
yeah,
here we are.
Yeah. Well, that was, you know, the rough idea of this plot, or the crux of it being a morality, ought to be a morality tale about, you know, geneticism and using that for the purposes of a greater good. That discussion is never there. It's all about the immediacy of one person being sacrificed towards that rather than what has happened
the
beforehand.
Background of this, though, Nigel Robinson got it in September of 1 year and submitted it in January the next. So he wrote it very, very quickly, and we levelled this criticism at Time Worm Genesis, and I think he's only had marginally more time, and his defence has done better than John Peel did, but it still reeks of, we have to get this out quickly. And there's a few drafts away from it, because
yes,
there's potential for a good story there's some nice ideas, it just doesn't come together as well as it could.
No, I mean, it reaches the touching kind of cornerstones that you would have within a story like this, in terms of, here's a perfect utopia, here's why that perfect utopia isn't so perfect, here's what they're doing actually, and here's what the Doctor and Ace face as a moral quandary. But it's just not fleshed out in that way, like we say. The points are just mentioned in a superficial way. But to be honest, one thing, you know, like we say, was not superficial, to be honest, was some of the characters, I want to say. I do want to say, like you said, about Murrow. I did actually enjoy Murrow.
You were invested in him. You genuinely wanted him to find out what was going on. Because... And even just his relationship with Raphael, the Cathedral mentor there, he reminded me quite strongly of Professor Yana from Utopia as well. Just, I liked him. Revna was just awful. The Procurator, what was his name?
Hulath? I can't remember.
He was just there to be the old... He was like the old commandant in the old war movies. He's there, everything runs fine, and then he falls to pieces when everything falls to pieces. And even just Revna reporting them and having them destroyed was like, yeah, okay, that's fine, that's done. We weren't invested enough to care in his fate. I was like, good, that's one less character I have to remember.
Yeah, it was quite superficial
Yeah,
for him in that
the one
way.
that also hit me quite hard was it Kraz, the former doctor? Yeah.
Oh,
That
Kraz,
was
yes.
nicely done, I felt, the old.
Yeah, and even to an
Yeah.
extent, Arun as well. I quite liked, bringing in that kind of side of here's the underbelly of this planet and what the Pangestry have been doing. But yeah, again, it would have been brilliant to have had
Yes.
that much earlier on, and really kind of interacting with the people in that town,
Well, this is where
exploring that horror
the Doctor
of
could have
the
done with two
reality quite
companions.
more.
It's just a shame the Doctor Who's never ever done that.
Yeah, there was no
That's.
companions. There was never two companions ever. They couldn't have thought of that
But
idea
an
in
extra companion would have
1991.
been quite useful, and that Ace could have been in the town, Doctor's in the library, and the third companion's off experiencing the unlike. And I really enjoyed the idea of the unlike, the failed Jethi experiments. I just didn't get their timing. Why they came out of the forest when they did, when they had all these revelations. It's like, why didn't you come out with this like decades ago? Why weren't you in the villages going, look what they've done to us? You're eating your people. You're eating your husbands.
Yeah.
It's.
Now yeah, I agree, and also just sorry that we sound that we're nitpicking a lot of this, but how did everyone forget certain people with the food? Like some people, I think at one point in the novel they were remembering, and they're like, "Oh, where's me grand? Where's this person?" Where I was like, "Well, but how does the food make you forget that particular person, and then everyone forget that particular person?"
It was, there's a
I don't know how
suggestion
that
that the
works.
food was making them susceptible to telepathic manipulation and that the Pangestry were doing that en masse, which just about worked when you figure that
Right.
the island was full of Pangestry. But then they got there and there was none of them there apart from Reptu.
Because the whole planet basically, they had an island, like we said, but that island basically is desolate with a teleporter that takes them to their second moon, which is the spaceship of the Pangestry. Yeah,
It
I
was.
mean, maybe they're that strong that they're just moonbeaming a telepathic connection to the entire planet.
I mean, now thinking about it, did we actually meet any Pangestry apart from Ritu and the Matriarch?
There were various ones running around scared near the end, I
Oh,
think.
that's right, the ones the Doctor said had never had any minds of their
Yeah.
own. Yeah, it's
Yeah.
just. Oh. Like I said, it was a nice idea, they just didn't. Concrete it down.
So, yep, so that's basically where we find ourselves with the characters within the planet of Kerith. But in terms of the Doctor and Ace themselves, how did you find their relation? How did you find them as, personified within Nigel Robinson's writing?
Well, Ace seemed to almost take a backward step. She felt like early Ace, like Season 25 Ace, 25, season 24, 25 Ace, quite
Yeah.
early on, quite everyone's talking codswallop, everyone's a hooligan, everyone's. Nitro 9 seems to be a continuing part of her personality. But I did like the bit towards the end where she get properly angry at the Doctor, which, as we know, becomes a bit of a recurring theme within the new adventures. And even if I disagree with why she was angry at the Doctor, as in it makes no sense why she would hold him accountable for something other than the author says he's accountable, it was still nice to see that in there. I thought the dynamic was just fine for this book. The Doctor was. We've seen the Doctor out of control, we've seen the Doctor lose his temper, we've seen the Doctor being violent, we saw it in the very last episode of Doctor Who before these adventures started. It felt like retreading it, and he felt even more brutal here. Like needing somebody in the nether regions, attacking a startled creature with a plank of wood into the stomach, accidentally killing it. It's like none of that felt doctorish. It was.
I mean, I would say he does get the Doctor quite well. However, I wouldn't say it was the seventh Doctor. I would say it's the second Doctor,
Well,
because
it...
like we said in that but earlier, there is flashbacks to this time worm induced memory of the second Doctor on the planet, and his writings of that is very nice. It's
Yes.
just very, not playful, but quite a wholesome view of the second Doctor. And I think it kind of ties into to Nigel Robinson himself, because he was, as a writer, he did some Target novelizations before
Yep.
becoming the editor. He focused mainly, I think it was on 60s ones. He did things like Age of Destruction, Censorites, Underwater
Underwater Bear,
Menace.
which I think was a Troughton one, wasn't it? So,
And so, because he, that in fact, in particular for that one, I think is why maybe he's pulled from that early Troughton. But he's just very
yeah.
playful. He's a very playful character, the Second Doctor, in those scenes, and I quite liked those scenes
Yes.
with him. The Seventh Doctor was a different kind of bag. Sometimes worked quite well for me. I think how he was trying to how he got on with Morrow and some of that relation, I quite enjoyed.
Yes.
Some of, like you say, some of the more just like kind of Hinchcliffian attacks on people were a bit sort of out of kilter sometimes, but overall, I still think he was fairly kind of consistent in some way. He wasn't, a perfect encapsulation sometimes, but I still quite enjoyed how that panned out for the most part.
Yeah, I mean, the convert. The scenes with the Doctor and Mirror were just brilliant. With the Doctor kind of quietly egging him on, going, "Right, you thought this far? Go on,
Exactly.
have a rebelling thought. You're almost there." And it was just, yeah, that was nicely done. It's the Doctor wandering about, going, "Yes, this isn't nearly as old as we thought it was." He's uncovering the conspiracy. It was very Seventh Doctor. I really enjoyed those moments. I've said that a few times during this conversation, and I stand by it. There's some lovely ideas there, and there's some lovely moments. And he gets flashes of the Doctor, but then he does things like put the Doctor in a fight, which should have been Ace's fight. Clearly, it was meant to be Ace. Once again, if only he had another companion that could have been there for him.
Indeed. Yeah, I mean, it's a very novel idea to have had a second companion. Who could have
Well, it
thought
is,
that?
aye.
Only
It's a
Russell T.
great
Davis could have thought
idea. Yes, the
that.
man's a genius.
Well, he does come from Virgin's New Adventure stock, so of course
Yes.
he would come up with innovative new ideas. But yeah, I think I could agree with you actually in terms of Ace as well. Like, not just in terms of, scenes that she ought to have been in, but even scenes that she was, where, like you say, I think one point she's goading the Doctor about being a scaredy cat. There's, quite a few instances where she's quite reactive
Yeah.
in her way. It is quite like a younger Ace in how it's written. I prefer that Ace over Time Worm Genesis Ace of just,
Yes.
being just like derobed in the TARDIS. And that was one feature actually that I found, interesting, that we didn't have much. Like, there is stuff in the beginning of the book about the TARDIS actually, them trying to arrive, and the TARDIS being a bit sort of, temperamental in some way,
Temperamental.
with some sort of future allusions of a cat possibly stalking the place. But I quite, yeah, it was
Yes,
nice.
that
But
was nice.
I had it was an interesting read when I was mentioning about the Doctor Who magazine interview they do with the Virgin Time Worm writers, because in that Nigel Robinson mentions that Peter Darvall Evans, the editor of The Range, was someone who was very keen to explore the TARDIS, which I think some folk in the 80s did try to avoid for the most part, especially around actually the McCoy era. And yet we've got, you know, Genesis with all its perversions in its first few pages within the TARDIS. We've got, yeah, like that happening
It's
there. We've got Exodus, which has got some exploration of the TARDIS and quite liberal usage of it by, you know, hopping around various bits of time. And this having its scene to talk about a temperamental TARDIS, and indeed actually the end of Exodus, you know, storing the well, beginning of Exodus is kind of going from Genesis of storing the time worm in the TARDIS and into its interface. There's a linkage with that within.
And I quite like the idea of the second Doctor talking to him through the
Yeah.
telepathic circuits. That was
Yeah, it almost feels like, you know, Peter Darwell-Evans as the editor has this idea of the TARDIS being a character in its own right, and kind of I think that's something that we'll get into when we go into Cat's Cradle more so, but it's something that's, yeah, he has that he wants to kind of explore, and it's almost actually, to be honest, a more
Aye.
prevalent character than the Time Worm itself, because we haven't even talked about the Time Worm because. I think I looked at it in the book, and the time worm is not mentioned until about page hundred
What's about
and
15 pages or so
ninety,
from the end, isn't it?
193. I'm currently on 93, 194.
Yep, so
Yeah,
6, 7 pages before
that's
the
where
end.
the, you know, the time worm comes out, and, you know, we have that showdown within the book.
Yep, and even then, you get the impression he wrote it, and
Yeah.
then he killed the time worm, and
The
the editors were just going,
time worm went back
"No,
home to
there's
its
book
home
four."
planet. It just disappears kind of away again. It's such a useless device. It's
It's
really unnecessary at this point.
and it's so blatantly unimportant to the whole plot of the book, to
Yeah.
the point where it was like I was getting towards the last 10, 15 pages going, well, we've not mentioned it yet, and I don't think I've missed it. I might have enjoyed this more if I hadn't been looking for the time worm all the way through it.
Yeah, I mean, there's
And
it's like a shadow time worm Genesis almost, because, you know, in Time Worm Genesis, the time worm tries to build an empire, well, a colonized workforce and Mesopotamia to help build her ship. And this.
But even in the Time Worm Genesis, though, there was still a feeling you knew who the Time Worm was
Yeah.
going to be. You knew it was the alien priestess. You knew it was going to be her. Whereas here, the Time Worm's revealed as being a character we've had throughout the whole book. Oh, and by the way, she was a Time Worm.
Oh, yeah, I mean, well, I mean, to be
Show
honest,
up.
I wasn't surprised that such a being, such as the
No, but I
Great
wasn't
Matriarch, would have
shocked
been
either.
that, but it was, yeah, it wasn't so much that it was the time worm, it was just, oh,
There was no, almost no
yeah,
foreshadowing of that. It was.
it's just tacked on at the end, which I'm happy that this is nearing the end of this arc, because it's not an arc that was, I don't know if arcs ought to be in place in this, and it shows with the rest of the run that there's very little arcs down the line that have this.
Although, as you'll find out when I infuse about it next episode, it finishes in
Yeah,
a high.
true.
But I'd actually forgotten I'd read this. I'd attempted to read the Doctor Who New Adventure several times, and I'd always stopped in this one. It's
I mean,
I think it's maybe the third or fourth attempt before I actually finished it before, because it was just
yeah, I mean, this is the thing. I don't want
awful.
to be too bad about this novel, because it's not bad. It's not awful. It's just, there's so much good Doctor Who out there. There's so much, you know, novels that like try and do something wild or
If it was
different.
a new
It's
series,
just a run of the mill story with some run of the mill characters, some quite interesting dynamics, but there's overall just Is it one that you'd be like, oh, do what I'm gonna do tonight, I'm gonna have a wee read of this? Probably not.
But it's also kind of annoying because if you told me, oh, this is a cross between The Doctor's Daughter and Utopia, I'd go, right, bring it on, let's have a wee read of this. And it is those things, and it's those things without the fun.
Yeah, and you know, for me, it's giving a kind of classic series comparison. It's like a mesh of episode one of The Crotons with State of Decay, which is probably not, you know, there's a lot of bid mead dashed through this book
Oh.
because of, you know, the Logopolis allusions and.
Well, it's not open with a Bidmead
Oh,
quote.
yes, actually, I think it is. Actually, let me double check that.
Yeah, it does. Yep.
Yep, there he is.
So it wears it on its sleeve.
Yeah,
It's.
it's very much focused on that sort of idea, which again ties into, you know, that area of the show. I always had my feelings about how Christopher Bidmead very much love this idea of science and technical science and lots of details about science, but really was lots of different fairy stories or mythical stories that were
Aye.
lost in the gobbledygook of technical babble, whilst some of the more scientific stories were all interesting scientific stories were from the season before, which always are seemed from the or from like a superficial level to be very fantasies or fairy style mythical stories,
Oh,
like,
it's
you know,
yeah, the juxtaposition is always entertaining.
yeah,
It's
and that's, you know, and you know, at least he's true to form with Christopher Bidmead in that aspect, because, you know, the mix up of the big crunch and the heat death stuff,
Oh,
it's following Bidmead's
it's very much in his
yes,
footsteps,
it's
yes.
fallen Bidmead's adhesion to science as he did in his show running time in the show. But I do want to say, you know, like I did quite like some of the writing aspects of each paragraph is starting with this sort of subconscious awakening. I
Yeah.
quite like that sort of forebodingness within the book, at least with how you wrote that.
Yeah, the kind of what turns out to be the musings of the God engine, it's as it kind of comes through. Because at first I thought maybe it was a time worm talking, which is like, okay, if I'm not actually seeing the time worm during the book, I'm okay with it if we're getting quotes about her at the start of the chapters, but it wasn't, but it worked quite well, and it meant when we finally got Raphael and the God Engine merging, we at least knew what the God Engine was and how it spoke. So it felt a bit more organic. But yeah, it wasn't all bad, is what we're trying to say.
Yes, no. And you know, Nigel Robinson goes on to write others down the line with
Yes.
things like Bathright. So it's the first stab for him. It's his first original Doctor Who book, so it's, you know,
Yeah,
it's trying something.
and writing Birthright carries him a lot of favour as far as I'm concerned.
Yes, and it's, yeah, it's something that is a novel idea to have an original story within Doctor Who at this time for a lot of these people, and it is just finding their feet.
Reading the Who Adventures with David J. Howe, Nigel Robinson says himself he struggled with the idea of not having a template, not having a story to adapt and doing it all for
Yes.
himself. And so if you consider this as his first original story, it becomes a lot more palatable. It's
Yeah.
he's obviously tried, he's obviously got experience in Who, and he's given it a good shot. He just hasn't quite landed a few things.
Yeah, and I would
But
say as well, even compared to, you know, his background being, you know, editor, before that he did all those Doctor Who quiz books in the 80s. He's deep in that lore. And the good thing is that he uses that lore within the book, at least for a plot device that's relatively, like, not harmless, but quite seamless within the story. Like, it doesn't stick out like a sore thumb that we have in the second Doctor, you know, being fed. And it ties into, you know, the
Yeah, I mean, the
the
inclusion of
time
the
with.
second dot Doctor is a lot more organic than, say, in Genesis, when the
Yes.
fourth Doctor appears out of nowhere, and then the third Doctor takes over so he can fly the TARDIS.
Yeah,
The
that comes
seeds of
out
the
as
second Doctor.
spitefulness of him just not liking the seventh Doctor with John Peel.
Yeah.
Within this, it makes sense because it's a point of weakness within the regeneration, it seems,
Yes.
for the second Doctor, and that control from the time worm gives some credence to this. So there's it makes sense within the book to have
Yeah.
this aspect kind of echoing backwards through from the second Doctor compared to, like you say, what happens in Genesis.
Oh God, I because I mean he finds the second Doctor, finally put the come face to face, as it were. It's not a huh moment, it's a ah moment, and that's a big difference.
So yeah, overall, I think it's not one I'm going to be picking up anytime soon. It's quite a bog standard idea. It's got some relatively okay characters, but it is not a standout novel from the series that you'd be recommending to people to jump on upon.
No, it's very much one. It's done. It's a
Yeah.
filler episode almost. To be, is that big of me describing it? It's
Yes, it's yeah, it's a fill-in episode in the form of paper.
yes.
It's filling the shelves up, and that's about all it might do for a wee while.
Aye, so it's.
But what I find interesting, going back in time, myself to about 1992, was looking at people's comments about this in Doctor Who magazine, because they had the You and Who section in their magazine,
Okay.
and surprisingly, very little people wrote in about Time Worm Apocalypse. By then, I don't know how fans were feeling, or if they had such enthusiasm to write in with their thoughts on such a book. But one such person did. This is Henry Mead from Whittlesey, in I think Cambridge. He talks about the whole Time Worm series, but on Apocalypse in particular, he says there's almost no faults at all, which to an extent I could agree with, but that's not to say that it's got many benefits to the story. He says, I didn't enjoy it so much at the start, but around the middle, I got quite interested. I like the idea of the time where I'm going back in time to the Doctor's second incarnation and catching the little girl, which, yeah, it's a better utilization of the past. Compared to say things like we've seen at the beginning of the series of books. But yeah, it's interesting how very little exploration there is within, fandom at the time. The only other thing I could find was Gary Russell's review in Doctor Who Magazine 180, which is actually quite positive at the time is something that he finds to be the best of the three.
Okay.
Which is, I wonder if he would feel maybe the same now. He does touch upon, how the Time Worm's hatred of the Doctor and Ace are at an all-time high, which, for a character who gets maybe 7 pages worth at the end, is hard to elaborate upon, perhaps. But yeah, he does quite sing the praises of the side characters quite a lot, which I can agree with to extent with people like Mirrell. But
Yes.
one thing we didn't touch upon with Mirrell actually was his ending, because he did just
Oh.
croak it by being eaten by a massive sea monster and is never spoken again. The Doctor doesn't talk about him barely at the end. There's no great, like respect towards a relatively solid character.
There's a wee line that says the doctor's grief about Mirrell seemed genuine, and then we
Yeah,
forgot about it. It's
exactly.
It put me in
It's so
mind,
fleeting.
yeah. It put me in mind. There was a phrase that me and my friends came up with when about the same kind of time that Revenge of the Sith came out. When we're talking about spoilers, rather than talking about a particular plot point, we'd say like that time Mace Windu got eaten by that shark, and we still use that 20-odd years later. But now it will no longer be Mace Windu get eaten by a shark. It'll be It'll be Mirrell getting eaten by the giant Loch Ness monster. Although that brings me to another point. How nice was it to see the English version of Locke come up and for the seventh Doctor to correct it?
Yes, proper Scottish representation from McCoy
That,
there. Loch.
yeah, I love that. Absolutely love that. And it probably went over most folks' heads, but it was like, yeah, spot on, I will take that. But yeah,
Exactly.
it was like, oh, poor. Yeah.
Oh yeah, and talking to folk, if you do want an idea of the monster that did kill Mirrell, it is the cover of the book. It is meant to be this battle, which I do wonder as well if you were a passing fan. Once again, you know, a passing person who watched Doctor Who 2 years ago or whatever, and you saw this cover, would this draw you in?
Well, interestingly, there it is. I'll send this over to you in a wee second. I've got the Who Adventures by David J. Howe, and in it there's an awful lot of these wee art in it, but there's also two almost early drafts of the covers. And it's the old what might have been. Hold on. And this will be with you now. It just looks.
Okay.
Yes.
I mean, yeah, so the I'll st for the listeners, the difference is, if you have a look at the official color cover, it's this kind of snaky, well, not even quite snaky, it's quite lobliest sort of creature with kind of withered wee bits coming off of it here and there.
Ah, it's kind of all defined, hanging together. Yeah.
Yeah.
Clumps of cells, yes.
But on the potential one that they've done from this draft, from Andrew Skelleher, it's almost like the Mara that's in the water. Which it's just more defined, perhaps.
Yes.
I guess the only thing I have as my issue actually is, to be honest, the composition. Because Ace just looks a bit sort of like seasick in all three of them, to be honest, from the draft to the
Oh.
original one, to the one that we see in print, because she's just kind of lurching over this boat in a sort of bizarre angle.
She looks completely uninterested in what's going
Yeah, it's basically the look many people might have during
on.
reading the book. I'm sorry, Nigel
It's.
Robinson. We don't mean it to be personal, but yeah, she it's an interesting
Once
sort
again.
of cover. I don't know. It's not something that having in the foreground where she is to be that person, it doesn't give that, again, the urgency of the situation. She looks disinterested when there's a massive monster behind her,
Yeah,
in the
it's.
same way many people would be is kind of disinterested within the town for the impending doom of the entire universe potentially.
Yes, it's an odd choice, but we're fans of Andrew Skelleher for the most part, and we're not going to
Yes.
blame him for this one. It's. I get the impression looking at that he probably had an editorial input about make it look more like this.
Yes, it's potentially that, and I think it's something that, you know, Nigel Robinson talks about, that he didn't give much input into in terms of the cover. It was mainly just some vague descriptions of characters and some of the exciting scenes that are meant to be in the novel, and that's what Andrew
Yeah.
kind of went away and worked upon. But yeah, it's to be honest, it's no Time One Revelation also in terms of cover, which
Yes,
I do
that's
look
a
forward
lovely
to.
cover, yes. There's
But yeah, so that was the comments that we had from the 1990s. We did ask around some people's thoughts for the 2020s about Time When Apocalypse, over 30 years later. So we did have a few
Yeah.
comments actually on Facebook about the book. So we had Damien Moss saying it was a good read, lots of Doctor and Ace in it, and that he enjoyed it. I'm a big fan of the Time Worm series, so all good. That's quite positive. Ross Moore says it's very simplistic in light of what The Range became. Basically, a target novelization with nasty bits here and there. Which,
Yeah,
yeah,
that's
I can see that. Definitely. And finally, we had Jay North, who said it's been over 20 years since I read it, but I remember parts of it and enjoying it. Which, you know, certain scenes, like we said,
Oh, aye.
there are the flashes of enjoyment that you do get out of this. So, yeah, it's part three of a four part book series. In essence, it almost feels like part three, in the same way that you might have had from a four parter Doctor Who story back in the day as well,
Yes.
where they're just kind of, holding still, holding steady. You're
Yeah.
just kind of keeping it going, keeping it trucking.
Yeah. The chase episode from Planet of the Spiders springs to mind. Everything is exactly the same at the end as it is at the beginning. Nothing has
Yes.
changed apart from the Doctor's carbon footprint.
So yes, if you would like to maybe get in touch with us, because we will be doing Time Worm of Revelation next, you can write into us in various forms. And we'll give that just at the end of the podcast. But for now, thanks again, Alistair, for joining.
My pleasure, Anthony, and we'll catch you next time.
Yep, we will soon. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Too Broad and Too Deep podcast. You can contact us on our email account at toobroadtodeeppod@gmail.com, and that's with the word two, T-O-O. Or you can contact us on social media, such as Twitter or Instagram, at toobroadtodeeppod, and that's with the letter two. We're also on Facebook with the Facebook page Doctor Who, Too Broad and Too Deep Podcast. Thanks again for listening.